Hi, my name is Danae King, and I'm a reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. I report on faith and values and immigration here. And today I'm here with Terrence McKiernan of Bishop Accountability, which is a national organization that tracks allegations of abuse by Catholic officials and publishes them online. So, Terry, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be here.
Great. Well, first of all, we're going to talk about a few things today, but tell me, first of all, a little bit about what you do and how you do it, how you find all the information that's on your site.
Sure. So I founded bishopaccountability.org back in 2003, and I and my colleagues track this very sad abuse crisis. We gather information and documents about it, and we post that material online so that anyone who needs to know, whether it's a Catholic person in the pews or a survivor trying to track the whereabouts of his or her own offender, or whoever you are and need information, we try to provide it.
So do you get it from dioceses directly, or how do you get documents like this?
Documents about the abuse crisis have come out more and more, I suppose, in this latest phase of the crisis. You know, I mean, this broke for the first time in Louisiana in the 80s, and then in Massachusetts in the 90s, and then Massachusetts and elsewhere in the 2000s. And in this more recent period, they've come out in settlements, in investigations, from a lot of different sources, especially in the United States. It's less common for us to see documents elsewhere, with a couple of exceptions. There are a lot of documents from Australia, for example, that have come out in a government inquiry. So we get them from lots of sources, and we try to put them together because they really talk to each other and they're useful to have in one spot.
Okay, so we're talking about this today because the Diocese of Columbus released a list of clergy accused of sexual abuse of minors on March 1st. Like I know a lot of other places have in the past, you know, 6 months to 16 years or 17 years. So you sent me recently a list of links to lists of clergy accused from different dioceses around the country. So tell me a little bit about how the information in those lists varies. I know our local diocese gave the name of the accused priest or clergyman, the ordination date, and their status. So whether they're, none of them are still serving in ministry, but basically whether they were laicized or left ministry or are now deceased. So what information beyond that is offered?
You know, the Columbus list is pretty minimalist. And there are other lists that are as kind of sparing with the details. But on the other hand, there are plenty of lists, including the very first one, which came out of the Diocese of Tucson in 2002, which actually provide information like assignment histories, where the priest was at various points in his career, and which sadly also means where he had access to children. So that's obviously important information to have, and there are a lot of dioceses now, as more and more of these lists come out in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury report, there are plenty of dioceses that are providing more information. Some even go farther than that and describe the allegations, count the number of accusers each priest has, provide pictures. There's a best practice for this, as there is for any worthwhile thing that you might do. And the best practice is a more extensive list than the Diocese of Columbus has provided, certainly.
Okay, so kind of on that note, I got to talk to our local diocese last week, and they said that they didn't, you know, include clergy assignments on this list for a variety of reasons. But one kind of interesting fact, I think, is that if an individual is accused at one time, they will, you know, say the assignments. So they'll send out a news release to the media and put it on their website, put it in the local Catholic newspaper that they run, and also in some parish bulletins, and it lists all of the assignments of that priest when they're individually accused. And so they say they do that because they want victims to come forward. But conversely, when it comes to a list like this, they say that they didn't do that because they think that it could expose a victim. So tell me a little bit about what your response is to the idea that it could expose a victim, but also their kind of differing practices.
Sure. In my experience, and I'm not a survivor myself, but I certainly know a lot of survivors in the course of my work, and I've never met a survivor who didn't want the career history of his or her perpetrator to be public. I think that it's not a very plausible assertion that a survivor wouldn't want that career history out there, because it would lead people to speculate whether that person was a survivor of that priest. I think that my guess would be that the diocese's thinking is along these lines, that they are motivated by an interest in connecting with survivors in a more limited fashion, distribute the assignment histories of a priest who's been accused. But their interest in connecting with that survivor might very well be that that kind of connection with a survivor, as opposed to being contacted and told that there's a lawsuit, is perhaps the preferable way for a diocese to initiate that contact. So by doing it in a quiet way, a way that might also be described as pastoral, a word that's sometimes used here, there is an advantage to the diocese, because if this abuse can be handled between the diocese and the survivor without lawyers involved, that can mean that compensation is lower, that the diocese is only going to have to reimburse for therapy. There are some advantages to doing it that way. Whereas I think there's a major disadvantage to providing the complete career histories of all the accused priests in a diocese. One of those disadvantages from the diocese's point of view is a real advantage from the point of view of the communities and also the survivors in those communities. When you look at a list like that, it's very easy to see what parishes got the most accused priests assigned to them over the years. And we found in our work that it's fairly common for there to be a certain number of parishes in a diocese that really seem to get a lot of accused priests assigned to them. This phenomenon is sometimes referred to as a kind of dumping ground for priests accused of abuse. And if you see all of the assignment histories of accused priests at once, you can also begin to intuit assignment practices of the diocese. Because, of course, the diocese is in the business of figuring out where to put its priests and how often to cycle them from parish to parish, what priest is good in which parish. And that kind of thinking also has to be engaged in if the diocese is in the habit of keeping accused priests in ministry. Where do they put them? What is their strategy? And if you put assignment history information out there and you also put information about allegations, well, someone like you, a person in the community, can begin to draw conclusions about what the policy was. And that's a kind of transparency which, from my point of view, is good, but from the point of view of the bishop, might be not so good.
Okay. So something you and I discussed a little bit earlier was that the diocese has said that, you know, it would take too long to kind of put these assignment histories together as well. And so in talking to the chancellor, they said that some files have a form in the front of them that lists every assignment that priest has had. But the further you go back, the less the details are there. And so they took 6 months, and they said they needed that time to form this list because they had to look through 2,000 clergy files. And so they kind of, you know, before they released the list, when they promised it, they said, we need several months, and it took them six. So I asked, why didn't you consider kind of that assignment history as you were taking those months when other dioceses took much less time? And they said, it just took us that long. You know, we had to dig through all these files. We wouldn't have had time, and that would have taken longer. So tell me a little bit about if it would have taken longer, you know, maybe for our diocese, are there other dioceses where it wouldn't take long and where it might be an easier process? I guess I'm curious how those other dioceses might have gotten a list out quickly and had more information.
Right. So in a way, there are two questions here. How does a diocese establish a list of accused priests, and how much effort is involved in revealing the assignment histories of those priests? I know for a fact that often the first thing that a diocese does when it decides to put out a list is they go to bishopaccountability.org and they print our list for that diocese, and they work from there, because our list indicates to them how much is publicly known about their accused priests, and it establishes a kind of baseline. It gives them a place to begin in deciding how many priests whose abuse is not yet known publicly are they willing to come forward about. Now, they, of course, maintain, because the Catholic Church in Rome requires them to maintain this, they maintain what's called a secret archive that contains the files of all the priests who have been accused of abusing children, and also priests who have been having other problems that might be considered confidential, you know, mental problems, drinking problems, whatever. So there's a separate file for all of those priests. It's a non-trivial task to go through the secret archive and separate out the priests accused of abusing children, but it's not an enormous task. To review all of their files and try to capture the priests who might not have wound up in the secret archives, but there is a complaint in the file that if they chase it down, is going to indicate that that priest has abused children. That's a bigger job, but it's still, if you're serious about it, a matter of months and certainly not a matter of years or decades, as it has been. You know, since this problem first surfaced to this point now, when dioceses are finally getting religion, if you want to call it that, and deciding that they really have to get these names out there. So coming up with a list is as simple to start as printing our list at bishopaccountability.org and then supplementing it with the people that they have in their secret archive file. And if they're looking for more completeness than that, reviewing the records of all the priests is certainly a bigger job, but a doable job. Now, once you have that list, are you going to publish the assignment histories of these priests? Well, every diocese in the United States, indeed in the world, maintains a career history of all its priests. And I've seen a lot of these career histories. They are one of the basic documents that are released whenever a priest's personnel file is released to the public. We have many of them on our site, and every diocese maintains one. It's actually, you know, to put it gently, a red herring for them to say to you, oh, it would be really hard to put together the assignment history of a priest. We might have to look him up in the official Catholic directory. That's really not true. They certainly, for every priest incardinated in the diocese, that is officially a member of the diocese, they have an assignment history which lists the church, the town, the start date, and the stop date, and goes like that through every single priest's career. So if they didn't want to kind of put that into attractive format, they could simply PDF each of those pages and link to it from the name of the priest in the list that they published, and you would have your assignment histories for those priests, and those assignment histories would be very valuable. I don't know of any diocese besides the Archdiocese of Philadelphia that does it this way, but Philadelphia actually posts those assignment histories on their website, and Columbus could do the same thing if they wanted to.
Yeah, in doing some research, I believe the Jesuits do that as well, but they're not a diocese, yeah, they're just an order of priests.
Yeah, and you bring up an important point, actually, because plenty of religious order priests over the years have worked in the Columbus diocese, and often religious order priests fall through the cracks as this phenomenon has unfolded of bishops deciding that they're going to post the names and often assignment histories of the priests who've worked in their territory. I think it's very important that other religious orders do as the Jesuits have done. The Capuchins have begun to do it. The Dominicans have begun to do it. We have some lists for the Benedictines, the Croziers. There are many religious orders in the United States, as you know, and the ultimate goal in all of this is to have all of the names of all the accused priests with their assignment histories, allegation histories, pictures, all the information that we need, including documents, to really understand what's been happening here. And the religious orders are as important as the diocesan priests are in forming a complete picture. You know, right now, I think a little over a third of the priests in the United States are actually religious order priests, and they're responsible for a fair amount of abuse. So their names and assignment histories are important in this picture, too.
Okay. Well, before we wrap it up, I wanted to note that, you know, when I talked to the diocesan officials locally, they had said that they want to think about, you know, the things that survivors advocates have brought up and hope that they add to the list, like these assignment histories. But they did say that, you know, they will continue to contemplate that and will likely add to the list. So with that, I wanted to thank Terry so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
And I really appreciate your reaching out to me. It's good to talk with you.